Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer, producer and host of this program, and it's good to be with you. While impeachment has dominated the national conversation, another issue has been a focus for lawmakers and advocates around the state. Education, teacher pay, school vouchers, and testing are just a few issues we've heard a lot about in recent years, and during this hour we'll hear from four state lawmakers. Representatives Phil Giaquinna and David Abbott, as well as Senators Dennis Cruz and Liz Brown, and an education forum organized by Northwest Allen County Schools and parent ambassadors for the district called Charger Advocates. The moderator was Andy Downs, director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. Andy will start things off in a moment. Please enjoy the show.
And let's go ahead and get started. Obviously, funding is one of the things that people always want to talk about when it comes to schools. And K-12 education sometimes is reduced to only funding, where it comes from, how it's spent. We know that it's much more complicated than that, and we'll get into some of the other issues later on. But we're going to start the discussion of funding by asking each of the legislators in general what they think where education funding should come from and how those funds should be used. And we'll go ahead and start with Senator Brown.
Well, I think we know where the funds come from now. About half the funds come from your local government, property taxes. About half come from state and federal. And the federal is going to be things like Title I, things like that. And so what I think is important is, frankly, I think we always need to start at the local first and make sure the funding from your property tax dollars is not only being collected properly, but also spent properly. And why do I say that? Because the Carroll School District here, Northwest, is a little bit unique because it's more homeowners as opposed to commercial and industrial. But other communities are impacted significantly by TIFs and tax abatements. And so when we talk about where there is loss, sometimes we talk about the property tax caps, which have been implemented into our Constitution years ago. We talk about that loss, but most of us are enjoying the benefits of those property tax caps. But we also need to understand, too, that as we grow our communities and put things into TIFs, where those property tax dollars are captured, and also tax abatements, so that we can go grow businesses and industries, that's a loss to school districts as well. It's a loss to a lot of other entities that would receive those property tax dollars. So I think that sometimes we don't often think of those dollars as also being out there that could be contributed. So that's something I try to remind people of.
And I do want to point out, whenever there's a question, any of you is welcome to answer it. And if you wish to pass, you're also welcome to do that. But obviously, on these opening comments, I have a feeling all of you will want to say something. We'll go next to Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Our budget for the state of Indiana per year is approximately, I'll just give you round figures, about $17 billion. Half of that, which is about $8.5 billion, goes to K through 12 education in Indiana. So our state is one of the top three states in the United States out of the 50 states, and given the largest percentage of our state budget to K through 12 education. So we spend a lot of our state money on K-12 education. And about 70% of that money that comes to the local schools is spent on salaries. So we have a lot of the state dollars that come are actually used for the salaries of the staff and the teachers and the school corporations. We have a school funding formula, and the biggest part of that is the tuition or the foundation amount of money. And that varies a little bit around the state and how much per student each school gets. And that roughly is in the area, averages about $5,500, $5,800 range for each average student in the state of Indiana for K-12 education. And we also have a risk factor involved, which is the second biggest pot of money that goes to K-12. And that's based on the poverty levels and income levels and food stamp people, recipients, and different things as far as high risk populations in the state. And so some schools, like Fort Wayne, would have a higher amount there than Northwest Allen would have in that area. And so that's the two major funding sources for education from the state level. And then we also give special education money. That's in a special category as well. And we have a couple other ones, but those are the main categories of where the money goes and where it comes from and how it goes to the schools here from the state government.
Thank you very much, Representative Abbott.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you for having us here today, tonight. It's been a busy day, so I don't know if it's day or night, but I'm glad to be here. I won't reiterate everything they said. As you know, there's about three sources of funding. Our federal dollars, the majority of that Title I money is federal, is Title I money and federal. It's about $1 billion a year that has compliance requirements in that, as you know, and in testing requirements. And of course, the tuition support that you get from the state makes up, as Representative Cruz just said, I think about $8.5 million or $1 billion a year. And then, of course, the local, and that's what I wanted to kind of touch on for me personally, is like you say, it varies on the district where you're at, but roughly around 40% of your property tax dollars go to your school corporation. I am carrying a bill right now that it hasn't been heard yet, but I'm hoping to have that handed down so that we can start getting that into committee and refining it a little bit. But Senator Brown talked about TIF districts. My bill will specifically address TIF districts as a whole. And what we're trying to do is add some transparency to TIF districts so that we know how these dollars are being spent. You know, they're a good economic tool, and we really want to support the economic development in our communities. You know, economic development and schools should be a symbiotic relationship because we bring in economic growth, we bring in new workers, they have families and they have children, and those attend schools, and that increases your EDM count, and it's more tuition support for your schools. But when TIF districts don't go away, they do their job, and they're supposed to bond and pay for the infrastructure to bring in and entice new industry to come in. When they've met that goal, but they rebond or they change the boundaries and continue the length of that TIF district, that captures incremental AV from the community that in turn in roundabout ways, it makes some of the properties hit their tax caps. When that happens, those dollars come away from 40% of those come away from the school. Now they come away from your libraries, your counties, your townships, your cities, but your schools have a lion's share of that money that they will lose because of those tax caps. My bill also, trying to address that situation, what I'm looking at is taking a school board member that currently is on an RDC board as an advisory position, make them a voting member. I think if the school has that much skin in the game, they ought to have somebody that is sitting at the table that's able to be part of the discussion. So that's a controversial issue, and I'm working hard to try to get some traction with that. But I just wanted to put that out there that, you know, there are some things we can do to help the schools, I think, as far as in addition to any more dollars, but allocating dollars that would go more towards, you know, our classrooms is what I think is an ultimate goal.
Thank you, Representative Giaquina.
Thanks, Andy. Good evening. I don't want to repeat some of the things that were said. Obviously, you mentioned tax caps past 2009 or 10, I believe, 2009. Actually voted against those. Mentioned which I think, frankly, has been part of the problem is where we gotten us into the mess, I think, that we're in currently. But with regards to TIF districts, I want to caution everybody, those are designed really to, you take an area where there isn't much economic development happening anyway, so the financing to help that's collected then from that area goes back to help revitalize that particular area. In the city of Fort Wayne, actually turn off the TIF district so then the money can, once it's up and going, the money flows back into the units of government that Representative Abbott mentioned. And two, just want to kind of go back to the budget that was passed last year and look at the increases for public schools. It was 1.59% and 1.75%. Charter schools, 11% and 10% respectively over the next 2 years. Virtual charter schools 9% and 8%, voucher schools 10% and 5% over the next 2 years. So the problem that we have is, you know, we have this pot of money here for education, and when you start to take it out and it goes to these different schools, voucher schools and virtual schools and so on, it dilutes and takes away then from traditional public schools. And that's really kind of the, I think, probably the crux of maybe what you want to talk about and those type of issues and debate whether or not we want to continue going down this road or not.
There actually have been a number of questions that have brought up the increase in funding, and not only raw dollars, but also in terms of percentage and comparisons to inflation, et cetera. There is some thought that perhaps education funding should be tied to some economic indicator, whether that's inflation, cost of living, some other sort of indicator. This might be unfair, but I'm going to ask Senator Cruz, since you have spent the most time on an education-related committee, what do you think of the idea of tying education funding to some economic indicator of some kind moving forward? And obviously everyone else will have a chance to answer that as well.
We do that in a way right now because we have a group that meets about every 3 months that does economic forecasts and determines about what they think the estimate of our income is going to be. So they update that every 3 months. So when we do our budget every 2 years, we have two of those during that time that come out that we use, and actually one comes out generally just a couple weeks before the end of session, and that gives us a good indicator of how much money is anticipated the economy will generate for our budget, which would include the schools, and then we base our final budget figures on those indicators now. So to have a fixed figure that would be in place for 2 years, I don't think would be as good actually as what we're doing now, because I think what we do now has been fairly accurate, actually. I think some years we're within 1% over a two-year prediction of what the income will be. We're within like 1% of what it is. So the system we have now, I think, is working very well, and it keeps in tune and in touch kind of with what's happening in the economy all the time and how much money we really got coming into the state.
Anyone else want to comment on this concept?
I think you pretty much said it.
Okay. All right. That's fine. Another topic that has come up, obviously, is teacher pay. Unfortunately for a lot of people, they reduce education funding to just teacher pay. Having said that, there are other issues, and we'll get to some of them. You've already brought some of them up. When it comes to teacher pay, people have pointed out that Indiana teachers do not rank high in this. And there's a concern that this is a problem in terms of attracting and retaining teachers. First of all, do you think that is true? And secondly, how might we address that going forward? And that's open to anybody who wishes to answer it.
Well, I think the legislature, every budget cycle and in off years like this year, we're always looking at that issue with the dollars that we have. And I'm just going to push back a little bit on what Representative Giaquinta said. Over 90% of our school funding dollars, about 93%, if I have my numbers right, goes to public school funding for about 92% of the students. And so the forecast and the increase that we talk about for non-traditional public school funding is the anticipation, the forecast of where those students will go. So parents have overwhelmingly appreciated the choice. So. And I think that's important. And I don't think it's also, because we're talking about dollars and where do these dollars come from. So we, teacher salaries are set at the local level. The state contributes roughly $6,000 per student. And Senator Cruz knows more about the complexity formula. And that's about half of the funding you receive. But the other half will come from the federal and the local. But it is a local decision on how many of those dollars actually go into the classroom. And so we had an interesting philosophical discussion last year and a policy discussion about how to get those dollars that we wanted to give last year in the budget cycle directly to the teachers. And there were some who, well, we'll just do that teacher appreciation grant and we'll drive more dollars that way. But we'd heard of some abuses in local school districts and how it was being spent. We should increase it to their bottom line, you know, in their pay. But we don't set your salary scales. We don't change the salary schedule. That's all collective bargain. That's not us. So how do we do that? So what we did last year was something, in my short time there, I don't know if they've ever done before, is we've decided we'd pay down the pension debt. We'd pay down 2% on every school district's pension debt roughly, with the hope and a prayer that those dollars that were freed up would be sent to the teachers. Most of the school districts did it, not all the school districts did it, and some superintendents were quite blunt in saying, we're not going to do that. We have other needs. We have capital needs, and we're going to spend it that way. We also did things to free up so that you locally, we, can have referendums, not just for capital projects, but also for salaries, for specific things. Some of those referendums this past year didn't pass. And so that's the locals deciding they're not going to vote to increase their local teacher salaries. They were very specific. And one more thing I'll say when we look at this is right now, and again, I'm not the newest, Representative Abbott is, but certainly I don't serve in education, so I know Senator Cruz knows more about the history. But we used to have many more silos of restricted dollars. And I recently had a conversation with another area legislator, and he has several school districts in his district up here. And he was telling me he's carefully watching to see if the operations dollars in that school district are being shifted, and some of them are. And so that's not the case in every school district, but that is the case in some of the school districts. Fort Wayne Community Schools took 7% out of their education dollars and put it into their operations capitals. So those are significant dollars in a budget that are the locals are making those decisions to take dollars away from the classroom. And that's why we struggle with how much do we put our finger on the scale. There was a bill last year that was going to require an 85-15 split. 85 cents of every dollar went to the classroom. What does that mean? It goes towards the teachers. And again, we don't set those policies. It was a suggestion then. And some school districts, like this one, are better at it than others because we don't, even though we represent one district, there are or one or two school districts, depending on the size of our district, we're legislating for the entire state.
Representative Abbott?
Yeah, being the new guy here, I'll jump in before the wisdom takes over. But to Liz's point, we are probably about 51% of our budget goes towards education, which is third highest. I know Vermont and Kansas are the only two states in the union that are higher. But that being said, when you look at the dollars that are spent for education and compare that with, you know, let's just say that we mentioned charter schools at, I think it was about $360 million we fund for charter and voucher total for the year. Phil's a good friend here, and I just want to just make one point on the dollars that, the percentage of increases that go to that. I think we mentioned a couple percent for public schools, and it was like 13 or 15% for charter. $360 million compared to $8.5 billion. Percentages are different. Dollar amounts are not percentages. So when you say 13 or 15% of $360 million versus a few percent of $8.5 billion, you have to put that in perspective. I just want, you know, just to think about that for a minute. That being said, I really do believe that, we've got a couple bills we're working on. One of them is to reduce, and this is to drive dollars to the teachers. I had a poll. You know, we send out mailers and they have surveys that we want you to fill out. We did a survey, and one of my questions was about how much of the dollars are actually going to the schools and how much dollars or administration. How much is going to the classroom? My report said that it was about 59% of the dollars go to the classroom, and the rest is going to admin. That really sounded pretty high. Now, we're going by the old system. We only had data from the year, school year 17-18. We didn't have 19 data results, so we were using that as the old four-silo system where the admin costs were spread out over the four silos more than they are now with the two. The two is the education and the operations. If you take that into account, Senator Brown said, the recommended is 15% for operations, 85 for schools, not to transfer more than 15% out of the operation into the or out of the education into the operations. There are school districts. I have one, and I won't mention it by name, but when you actually look at that 59% state average, I think that particular school corporation was about 60%. But when you look at the two-silo system, and this is a little misleading, and it gets a little complicated when you get into all these funding formulas and how the Office of Budget Management calculates these numbers, that same school comes out around 93%. That's pretty good. Now, I'm not saying all schools are that way, but still, you know, and they could be an outlier. But the point is, well, however you figure that, however the Office of Budget Management figures it, or how you calculate how much classroom dollars are actually going to the classroom or how much are going to administration, I believe, it's my belief too, that there's, if you want to pass blame around or if you want to look at ways to solve the problem, it's a two-way street. We have to look at what can we do as legislators on unnecessary burdensome regulations and testing requirements at the state level. Now, I'm not talking about the federal level. Title I's got its regulations you have to go by. That's $1 billion. We can't afford to lose that. But at the state level, I mean, there's a book, and you've seen it. It's about this thick. It's all the regulations. There was a study done over the summer, a group of people at the State House and in the fiscal. There's about 1,500 regulations we want to look at to see if we can't reduce or get rid of them. And in my opinion, I think the secret, not that we're third in the nation on how much of our percentage of our budget goes to education, but how can we make the teacher's job easier with less testing? We still need testing. We need accountability. But how much of it is needed? How much is it overburdensome preparing for these tests? For administration that has to be hired, regulations that have to be followed, counselors, paperwork. That's 1,500 regulations we're looking at, and I think that's the key to the future for me is working together. School corporations, legislators, school boards, and I don't want to leave that out. That's the third piece of this, that we really need to find common ground and look at ways to be more efficient and get out of your way as much as we can. Let the teachers do their job. And we know there's accountability. We have to find that sweet spot. To me, in my mind, I'm a new guy, so I'm looking at this in a maybe a simplistic point of view, but I think there's some work to be done. In my mind, it's going to take some time. There's a lot of moving pieces. I mean, currently the governor's commission on education hasn't even had the results come out yet, so we'll probably get into that later, but I'll leave it at that. I think it's yet to be seen where we're going to go, but I think there's some good things coming.
Question or comment, Representative G? Yeah, please,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yep, thanks. Is this like a presidential thing? When they mention your name, you get to extra time or something? Yeah. Presidential debate.
Ask for time back.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. I hear a lot about the local school boards doing what they have to do, but really it starts with the state legislature. And as one superintendent told me, there's just not enough money into the system. And if there's enough money there, then the school boards could do what they needed to do, find more money for increase for teachers. I sort of think back to when all this sort of got started back in 11 and 12, that, you know, if a student leaves a school, a classroom of about 20 or 22, say now we're down to 21 students, you still have to heat the building. You still have to pay the teacher. But the school loses money and the corporation loses money because that student has left and took a voucher and went to another school or went to a charter school. So the bottom line is we need to keep putting more money into the system, in my mind, for traditional public schools. And I know your original, I think you're going with questions regarding teachers and why are they leaving. I think we rank really high the number of teachers that exit after 5 years on the job. There's a couple different things. I mean, obviously, it's just what they'll tell me, it's no fun anymore. We've taken the creativity out of things, all this, the testing. Teachers tell me they're basically teaching to the test. So in a short answer, it's not much fun anymore. And frankly, teachers want to be paid more. That's not always their number one priority. They want to be able to do the things. They want to be able to teach. That's what they got into the profession. But yeah, they need, want to be able to earn more money. I've been told stories from superintendents around the area, examples of teachers having to leave and getting into other businesses because they just couldn't make enough money. And Andy, you started to talk about where we rank within salary growth over the last 5 years, and it's not very good in the state of Indiana. So a lot of, we need to look at it. I mean, I'm glad the governor, I think we could speed it up a little bit. That's certainly his prerogative to take another year and look at it. But then with regards to some of the administration costs, public schools are around, I don't have my data with me, I think it was around 10% or something like that. But the number I saw, like for example, for charter schools, administrative costs is like in the 20 to 25%, it's even higher. And then a lot, and I know Superintendent Hemsel was the one that rattled off a list when we were in a meeting back in the fall. There had to be 35 mandates that the legislature, and some of them pretty good, no doubt, but that we've required a school system to do. Well, guess what? You got to hire people to oversee those things. And so we're the ones that sort of create these things, and then the school administration and the schools and the school boards have to come up with money and find ways to pay people to administer these mandates that we put on the schools.
We are going to get to testing specifically in a little bit. I want to see if I can get you to help reconcile the differences in variables that people might use when looking at funding. So, for example, you talked about the rank for the state of Indiana in terms of funding compared to percentage of the state budget devoted to education compared to other states. Some people in the audience have brought up cost of living and how the amount of funding going to schools hasn't kept up with that. Senator Brown pointed out that you all put money into a pot, but decisions are made at the local level. How do we have a discussion where so many variables can be brought in that help to support a position contrary to a position legitimately supported by other variables for other people? How do we get beyond that, so to speak?
Well, money is the main answer. So last year in the budget, we appropriated $760 million more. So we went from a little over $7.5 billion up to $8.5 billion. So that was the biggest increase that anybody can ever remember in our lifetime, and dollars weren't that much prior to our, at least me being down there. I've been here 31 years now. So we gave the largest increase ever, maybe as much as almost twice as much as we ever gave before. And then 2 years prior to that, our budget, we gave $350 million more. So we've actually increased public education in K through 12 by $1 billion the last 3 years. And I think we need to keep doing that. I think it's not good that our teachers are not getting a starting salary of at least $40,000. You know, I think there's still some schools where you're making $32,000 or $33,000 starting after a college education on a salary as a beginning teacher, which I think is too low. And so one of my goals is to keep funding enough money till we can get up in the $40,000, $42,000 starting pay. And you do have local referendums. There's 12 or 15 of those every year. About half of those have been passing, half of them failing. But there are a number of schools that are using that to help teacher pay. So Indianapolis Public Schools just passed one. I don't know the exact amount, but each teacher is getting, I can't remember exactly, but $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 more per year because their referendum gave a bunch of that money to teacher pay. So that's another alternative that you can have, and one of those different things that sort out all the money that local people that want to pay more money to their teachers, they have a option to do that locally. There's a lot of forces at work in the state budget, and there's prisons and highways and parks and mental health and all the Department of Children's Service and all those other things. They have needs as well, and they're all at the state house as well lobbying for their money. And so it is a difficult balancing thing of all the sources of revenue and money and where it comes from, how you put it all together and stuff. And a lot of people say there's only about a half a dozen people that really know the school formula well in Indiana. So that should tell you a little bit of how complicated it is. It's hard for us to understand if we've been there a long time.
When we're talking about funding, I would be remiss if I did not bring up choice scholarships, vouchers. Several questions came in beforehand. Several have been handed to me right now, and they fall into sort of two categories. One of them is should we place limits or should there be requirements about where a voucher could be used, whether that has to be used by a student who is in a, quote, failing school district, or should they be available more broadly? That's one generic kind of question. Another question actually gets at accountability for those dollars. In other words, if a school is receiving the scholarship dollars through a family, should they have to report to State Board of Accounts, say, the same way a public school does? And I'll invite any of you to comment on either one of those or both of those, if you wish.
Well, the
Senator Cruz,
yes. Go ahead, voucher Cruz. Money actually goes to families. It doesn't go to the school. So the individual family gets that money, and they decide which school they want to take that money to. So really it's not the accountability of the school. It's the accountability of the parent who receives the money, and they're the ones who are responsible to make sure that money is used properly by the school they enroll their child in. So that's maybe a fine part of the law, but that's what the law is. It goes to families.
And I understand. When I asked the question, I did say the money goes to the family and the family uses it.
Yeah.
Do you think that's appropriate, I guess, would be the better way to put it. Do you think there should be some mechanism for tracking the use of those dollars beyond Jane Doe's family received this dollar and used it at school X?
I think it's adequate now. I don't think we need to have any further accountability in that area of the voucher schools. I think that's one of the reasons why we have a voucher school, is because they don't have to abide by the regular public school thing. It's set up differently, and parents have a choice to do charter schools, voucher schools, to go to public school, So the parents have those choices out there, and I think we do have different amounts of accountability in each one of those. But when we originated the voucher law, one of the things that they said in getting it passed, which Representative Giaquinta did not like, but doesn't like today, but it did pass and became law, that we would not have additional regulations on them. That was part of the law that we created, and we've pretty well stayed that way since we passed it, I think, in the exact year of 2010 or 11 or somewhere in there.
11.
Yeah.
Representative Giaquinta,
yeah.
Comment?
Yeah. So I was... Senator Cruz and I were, you guys weren't here in 11, no.
No.
So Senator Cruz and I were here,
yes.
In 2011. I was near the Senate, I was in the House. And so I can only speak, you know, for myself here as far as how it was sold on the House floor was, this is to help poor students trapped in a failing school. And I had asked the question, you know, what happens if it's an A student in a great school, but wants to go to a different school because they want to play football, or he or she may have a girlfriend or a boyfriend or something, or I don't know. You know, it's besides what we're in. And I mean, there was nothing on a form or anything like that that you would check off for any reason that you had to give to receive a voucher, And of course, as it turned out, we have A students leaving A schools to go to a different school. Primarily, but to be honest, it's really probably for religious reasons, because they want to be able to go to a religious school. And then the income eligibility has continued to climb. And I think you can, what is it now, family earning maybe $90,000 or something. I mean, it's pretty high. So it's really got, I mean, that's kind of where we started, how the voucher program was talked about and sold to folks on the House floor, and it really, as Senator Cruz has indicated, it's really just become really more of a scholarship for students who want to be able to go to a non-traditional public school.
I think that is important, though. It's not the fact that the parents have a choice, and I think that what we've seen universally in some of our larger urban public school districts, that parents are using that choice to leave schools, and it's not necessarily because they're failing, but it's not a good fit for their student. And they may come into your system or go out of your system. And Fort Wayne Community Schools is a good example of them receiving and also sending students to neighboring school districts, not the voucher students going to non-public or not a public charter school, but going to another public, traditional public school. And I think that has something that has resonated across the state loud and clear, that parents, you see the largest number of parents participating in that kind of a choice when they don't feel that they're getting what they want from their traditional public school. They're going to a neighboring public school district. And I think that's important. But I also think when we talk about accountability, certainly the dollars that follow, at least I feel strongly, the dollars that go to a student is, the goal ultimately is they, their parents, find a place where they will get the best education. And anyone who's had children know it doesn't always, it's not always a cookie cutter approach where the same school is not going to work for every child, in the, even in the same family sometimes. And so sometimes they may be in a variety of different settings, charter, online. And I've had conversations with some of those parents. And I think that's something we need to respect. But I also think with respect when we talk about these dollars is I go back to the fact that with the non-traditional public and or choice scholarships that we're talking about, it's 6-7% of the school funding K-12 monies we're talking about. So I think it's a little misleading to think that those are dollars being taken away from a traditional public school setting. We're always trying to make sure schools are adequately funded, but the pot has gotten bigger because we're trying to serve students and give their parents the best opportunities for their students. But those dollars are not necessarily dollars that were already in a public education pot. As Senator Cruz alluded to, just in the short time I've been in the legislature, just public health, if you want to talk about the opioid crisis or mental health issues alone, those dollars could be sucked up in a hot minute for other funding. There are always other needs out there. And so it is. It's a difficult balancing act.
This is obviously something we could probably talk about for the full time we're supposed to be here. But at the risk of cutting it short, there's one final question. It's actually quite specific. Several people have mentioned it. Apparently, recently, the state board eliminated CTE funding for family and consumer science classes. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. Does something like that concern you? Because it's targeting a very specific part of the education for a lot of students, and one that actually creates a track into employment for some that does not necessarily require going to a 2 or 4 year institution afterwards. First of all, are you aware of this? If you were not, is this something that you'd be willing to look into for folks and report back to Superintendent Hensel about?
Yes. I think it's okay. I think it's bad if they're taking money away from that. I would do all I can to make sure that money is funded for those career technical education classes.
Okay, great. One person has clapped for you. There are two, three, four, more and more clapping. Very good. As I said, we could spend the entire night on this. Several of you brought up accountability already. It's a complicated issue. It may be more complicated than funding, in spite of the fact that only six people know what the funding formula is in the state of Indiana. There is a reliance on tests, graduation rates, different sorts of measures. And this is, I'd like to get you to start by just sort of generally commenting on how you understand accountability in the education, public education system. To whom should schools be accountable, for example? And this time we'll start at this end of the table, so we'll start with Representative Giaquina.
Okay, give me the question again.
Sure. In your mind, how do you define accountability, and to whom should schools be accountable? Eventually we'll get to testing and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, you have an elected school board. They hire the superintendent. The superintendent oversees the schools. You know, I someone told me one time, if you want to see a successful, every successful school has a really great principal. Mm-hmm. You know, though, and I know for a fact that, and I see Steve Crone out here, but Fort Wayne Community Schools, they'll move a principal from one school to the other. They feel that principal fits a need to, you know, if there's an opening at one, I remember
drawing a blank on his name, I think he went from Elmhurst to Northside at one time, and there was a principal there who, of course, maybe Northside, or excuse me, Elmhurst might have been closing at the time, but they definitely have moved principals around. You know, I've talked to the head of teacher unions that will tell me, you know, we are not afraid, for example, of the idea of firing poor performing teachers. Everyone has to be accountable. We're accountable. We're accountable in the we're in the jobs that we have. And I think that most of us probably up here would agree that locally is much better with the elected school board, things like that.
Okay. Representative Abbott?
Well, I'd have to start to say, having five children of my own and their memories of being in school was, I remember Principal David Pine was at the Rome City School, moved to the Villa School. He had a lasting impression on our son. And I had similar stories with other teachers and principals, especially teachers. You know, they made an impression. So I'm going to say you're accountable to the children first, and then your school board and your principal. I think you need to be accountable at the local level. But on the other hand, and I think that's where the lion's share of the accountability should be, there's some oversight, you know, and I think that's at state and federal level. I mean, ESSA requires that. We have no choice in that. So there's going to be accountability there. We know that. And for good reason, I guess. But state-wise, you know, by constitution, you know, that was our charter to be responsible for our education system. So in my mind, minimal, I think minimal is less is better. So I would leave it at that. I'll go back to those regulations that are this thick. I think it needs to be a lot thinner. And let the local schools be the accountability and the main accountability vehicle or recipient. So.
Senator Cruz?
Well, the public is the group that we are the most accountable to. We as elected officials are accountable to the public who vote us in and out of office when they like us or don't like us. And next to that, I think families would be the main one, with the parents who send their kids to school and then the kids themselves who attend school. I think we have some accountability in them to make sure they're getting the best education possible that they can in our state. And I think the local school board is also elected in 90-some% of the school corporations in Indiana. So I think they also have a level of accountability as elected school board members, because they're the ones that kind of make the final decision. They hire the superintendent, but they still have final word in most things. And if you've never watched the principal story, there is the Wallace Foundation has it's about an hour long movie. It's actually $15 million they paid for it, but it tells you the importance of a principal in a school. If there's one person that's most important in a school setting, in each school, it's the principal. So they can make a huge difference. And I think we need to make sure that we have the best principals in the schools that we possibly can.
Senator Brown.
I think to echo what my fellow legislator said, I feel we are accountable first to the students and the families to make sure that they are educated to the best of our ability to get them where they need to be. I think it's important when a child graduates from an Indiana high school with a diploma, whatever that high school is, that it means something. And we should be able to, when they go on to college, regardless of the college, that they're prepared adequately. And we should all be concerned if our students graduate with a high school diploma and they have to remediate. Those are the kinds of things that we struggle with. How do we guarantee that that's going to happen? You know, that what we think they've learned, they've actually learned. What does that score mean? What does that grade mean? What does that honor mean when they graduate from high school? I think some of the accountability sometimes, yes, goes too far. But I go back to the story. I think it was the first year I was elected, and I was a principal for a day in a Fort Wayne Community School building. And the end of the week, every week, on their iPads, the teachers had to answer 105. It was 105 questions about their interactions with their students throughout the week. That was just mind-boggling. That would be spirit-killing if I had to do that. That's not a state mandate. That was a local school decision to track all of those things, the questions that they had. And I remember a lot of them, and I just didn't see the relevance to those questions and how it was going to impact the teacher in the classroom. That's not our intent. But on the other hand, as I said, we look at a lot of different districts. How do we make sure that they're spending the dollars and the students are getting an education, that they're not just passing them through, and the child comes out of high school and realizes, no, they really aren't much past the sixth or seventh grade. We have to figure those things out. I'm currently serving on the Distress Unit Appeals Board, and Gary Schools has been taken over by the state of Indiana. I think 2 years ago, they were $100 million in debt. It was a travesty for that community, how mismanaged that school district was. And their population has dropped. They have reduced it with the takeover manager to $90 million in debt for a school system that has less than 6,000 students in it. So the waste that was there and the loss, not just in dollars, in the educational quality that was going on is hard to recover. And that's not my community and that's not my district, but I feel for them. That's a huge hole to dig out of, and not just in dollars. And so those are the kinds of things we look at. We have school districts that have less than 1,000 students in them, I think even less than 500 students in them with the superintendent.
Hamilton K through 12, Hamilton Lake has 270 students in K through 12.
So, you know, and everyone wants their school district to be vibrant and to serve their students. And obviously, they can't offer all the wonderful things a larger system like the system we're sitting in today in. But what we want to do is to be able to tell any parent in Indiana or an employer in Indiana as well, when you get a Hoosier graduate, you're getting a great student. And they're going to do well, whether they're going into the workforce or whether they're going on to some post-high school degree. So that's kind of the accountability I look for.
And I think it's interesting that when you talked about accountability, you all brought up several factors, yet all too often the fixation is on a test, whether it's iLearn or, and its predecessors. You know all the complaints about it. It causes anxiety among students and parents and teachers. Teachers devote time to teaching to the test, not to teaching. We spend a lot of money on testing, and yet it's only one way in which we could measure that. We know tests as a method of assessing what students have learned. That happens. It's been happening for decades, will happen for decades. How might we actually measure accountability within the school districts, not as a test? Who'd like to take a stab at that one?
Well, grades. I have utmost confidence in teachers, and I've been in dozens and dozens of schools, and I've always said we don't need a state test of any kind. I don't need any statewide test to have me say how well my student's doing in a school. Every teacher knows. If they're a good teacher, I should say, I shouldn't say every, but most all teachers, I think, know their students. They know what they're doing in the classroom. They know if they're learning or not learning. They're giving them their quizzes and 6 weeks or 12-week, 18-week tests and semester-ending tests. And I was just talking to one of the teachers up in DeKalb County in a school, and this was when I-STEP still, this was a couple years ago, so they were taking I-STEP. He said, I'm going to write down on a piece of paper what every one of my kids are going to get on I-STEP. And he said, I'll put it in a sealed envelope. I'll give it to somebody else. You can put it safe or keep it. When they get the results out, you open it up and see how close I am. And he is so accurate, it's unbelievable. And I think most teachers know, and I have confidence in them. And I don't think we need anything else outside of that myself. Now, we are in a system now where the federal government now requires us to do this standardized tests, you know, once a year, and I don't like that, and I don't think the federal government ought to be telling us either, and I don't think we ought to be telling the local schools, so I would be in favor of doing away with the statewide test totally. In fact, I've introduced legislation in the past to do that.
Representative Abbott.
I'll add just a quick comment as far as the testing goes. There was some legislation that was introduced last year to require, it was for accountability. We wanted to know how the schools were succeeding. The idea was, let's track them for the next 5 years and see If they're successful, that means that would show that the school is successful in preparing that child for his career or her career. The problem with that, of course, is I think it's pretty obvious to all of us, and thankfully that bill never got traction, never passed out. I'd be a perfect example. That first year out of high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't go to college right away. Some other people may want to climb mountains for a living or go work at McDonald's, but eventually, or work for their dad, become an entrepreneur, and then become a very successful person. That's not a way, you can't track a person's success by the next few years out of high school. Sometimes people have to get out on their own. They have to struggle. They have to fail. Most successful people fail many times before they're successful. So I think that's, you know, Senator Cruz kind of indicated about the testing. I'm also going to say accountability going in the future. You can't judge performance and success by a test like that or what their life's going to be in the next few years. They're going to figure it out, and if they've got the training, and if they've been, and I think most teachers are dedicated, devoted. I've talked to many teachers that put in many dollars of their own money above and beyond what they're allowed to have in the classroom because they care about those kids. I haven't been to one classroom. I've been to many classrooms just in the almost 2 years now. I've been a representative, and I've never seen one that either wasn't near tears talking about the frustrations they have in the classroom. So I think they're almost self-accountable. Yeah, we have our place for accountability as far as the state's required, but I think the teachers and the schools are doing a pretty fine job, and we don't want to burden any further accountability after that, you know, to any degree that would track someone's life. I don't think that's the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown?
When Senator Cruz said, you know, we kind of got into this, I guess, with the feds. I had written the history down at some point, but I lost it.
No Child Left Behind is the first under George W. Bush administration when they first put in the requirement for the federal government to require state governments to give a statewide test to all the students.
And then the next administration, Every Student Succeeds Act. So there have actually been some people at times have floated the idea of just saying the heck with it and foregoing the $1 billion in federal money. And is it really all going into the classroom anyway? Can we make it up or whatever? But I don't think anybody's really going to go that route anytime soon. So we have to manage it better. But I do think this last go round with the iLearn is an example of it. Seems simpler than it is. Superintendent McCormick and the Department of Education were tasked with something close to an off-the-shelf test, and it was their job, with the help of educators, to come up with some kind of test. And clearly, as I think both the House and Senate have discussed, or will be discussing in the next few weeks, hold harmless bills because of, I guess, the debacle of the iLearn. It's a learning process for everyone. And so, yes, I think there is a strong sentiment that can we do what we have to do with respect to the federal government so that we're in compliance and make it as simple as possible. And I think we saw with, because like I said, I have to defer, I'm not in education, but I think Superintendent McCormick inherited the last test, if you will, from the previous superintendent, but this one was hers, and it's harder to do, obviously. We've all seen that. And it is frustrating, and it's frustrating as a legislature. That's millions of dollars gone, and it's frustrating to parents because their children have been sort of juiced up for these things, and then it doesn't count. So what does that mean? But I echo what my fellow legislators, and as a parent, we know that the teachers know what their children are doing, and they are more competent and aware of where all of the students are in their classroom than, you know, having these outside sources come in. But there, I think, should be some accountability. I don't think we should be afraid of it. And maybe the way it's been done with the letter grade is not the most perfect. I think we could probably agree with that. But I think I go back to, we have a good system here. And we have a good curriculum in Indiana. So we should be able to justify it and prove that it's working. And so when people come into our state or leave our state to go elsewhere, whether it's college or a job, there is an assurance that, yes, your education meant something and that diploma means something.
Representative Giaquino?
Yeah, thanks. So I think we've spent, I don't know, around $133 million over the past several years on tests, $42 million on iLearn. I agree with Senator Cruz. I know we have to do a test, but let's just have one that's practical and doesn't have to cost so much money. The good news is I feel like we're starting to undo a lot of things that we've done in the legislature over the past few years. I mean, we're going to vote on a bill next week that mentioned the hold harmless with regards to the iLearn results. We're going to undo the fact that these results from the tests impact teacher evaluations. It's something that I had voted against way back when it was first passed. I think you said it well, Senator. I really do. That, and I said it earlier too. The idea that we have these tests and that folks that we're teaching to the test because of the things, the grading of the schools, the A through F results, the evaluations of teachers, things like that, really relied on what the test results were going to say, was really, I call it, frankly, high-stakes testing that really is detrimental to the classroom and to teachers and overall.
Mm-hmm. Anyone make any additional comments about the hold harmless legislation? Or, I'm sorry, Senator Cruz, you had something else to say?
Yes. I think we ought to realize teachers establish our standards, our academic standards in Indiana. They review them about every 7 years, and I've been part of a couple of those groups of teachers where I sit in on them and listen to them evaluate, do we want to keep this standard, do we want to change it? And, you know, there's hundreds of them that deal with each topic, each subject matter, and the teachers really, I mean, it was deep and thorough in their evaluation. Should this standard stay or should we tweak it a little bit or change it? So those standards are what the textbooks and the textbooks should be based on the standard, and then the teacher ought to be teaching according to those standards as well. So ideally, the iLearn test is based on our standards, so the teachers should be teaching that, and the students ought to be learning that in this one time a year. To take that test is kind of an indicator of what those kids have learned through that school process. So I thought that you'd everybody know that that's the way that system works and how you develop test questions are based on the standards. So a testing company who develops those questions, base them on our standards.
Quickly, back to the issue of the hold harmless legislation that was introduced very quickly. There seems to be, I don't say universal, but awfully broad support for this. Do you assume that this is going
to pass? Well, it's passed second reading in the Senate today, so it'll mm-hmm. be probably third reading Monday. We'll probably, I think it'll pass. Did you do second reading on the?
Yes.
Yeah, so the House has done the same thing.
Yeah.
My feeling is, maybe I'm saying this too quick here, but maybe by a week from today, the government might sign that into law, yeah. And that'll be a 2 years instead of 1 year. So it's actually going to be a 2 year hold harmless. So it'll be 2 years that no school will have any grade less than they had in the 17-18 indicator, I guess, the test results. So we'll have 2 years of hold harmless action instead of one, which I think is okay too.
Senator Brown, you brought up the idea that this should be, I don't want to say a simple thing to do, and obviously it was much more complicated than that. Do any of you have some suggestions for how this might be simplified? I mean, someone actually wrote in, how about we don't do this through technology until students are fully versed in the technology that will be used to take the test?
Well,
and there are issues like that out there, but there must be other ideas. And I see Senator Cruz and Brown.
The Iowa standardized tests I took. I mean, I'm that's 55 years, more, I don't know, probably 65 years ago I took that test.
Way.
Yes, I did.
I thought you meant you took it recently. And I want to know how you did.
I'd probably fail it if I took it out. But
it
was a one-day test. They still have that test today. And I think it's like a 6 or 8 hour test today. We spent $42 million developing iLearn. I don't know if iLearn's $25 or $30 million a year then thereafter. But we could still do that one for like $12 or $15 million. So we could save at least half, if not two-thirds, of the money we're paying now just by having the Iowa standardized test and have the kids take that in a day and a half and everybody take the same time and get it over with.
But to your point about the change of the technology, too, I think I've had a parent tell me that she had to buy a mouse, which is funny because I don't have anybody in that range anymore, obviously. She had to buy a mouse to teach her child because it was all iPad and touchscreen because the test was going to be on that. And then the other principal told me how they had to run their students through to learn how to do math and drag it down. And, I mean, I think there are obviously a lot of teachers. I see heads nodding here. So, but that's not us. I mean, that's the Department of Administration contracts for that, and that's the deal they had with the testing company. I mean, I hate to be old school and say paper and pencil, but, you know, we still have paper ballots in some places. I mean, maybe that's the way to go, because at least you know if the power goes out, then there's no stoppage. And I don't know, bubbles are not accurate when you fill them in, and we don't want any hanging chads kind of thing, but still, but that's, you know, we don't get involved in that kind of minutia, and that's what you struggle with. When I thought, oh my goodness, you know, it was a big deal when we got a mouse and a computer, whatever. So I would never have thought of that. Yes, I think those kinds of things, it would be nice if someone in charge, but we're not in charge of that part of it. So, yeah.
I went to one of the test grading centers with 1,000 people that were hired to grade the ISTEP test when we had it. And to look at some of the writing that the students did, I've looked at several of them and I thought, how do you read this? Because their handwriting was atrocious and they were doing essay answers. And that was part of the problem of doing it by pencil, is it just was really hard and it was expensive to hire all those people for several weeks and maybe even several months actually to grade all of those. So, you know, the computer thing, I'm not a big computer fan, but the iLearn test is all computerized and every student had to take it by computer. I would say, and I have a bachelor's degree from Indiana University, and I had a teaching license for 5 years, and had a lot of life experiences. If I took the eighth grade iLearn test today, I don't know that I could pass it. I think I might fail it. So it's a pretty rigorous test.
Stay with us. Part 2 of the NACS Education Forum can be found on the same page at wboi.org.